call your mommy, your daddy, and all your friends and tell them New York's number one podcast app is blowing up the airwaves and they can't do nothing about it. Bashani Radio app. We global, baby.
Yeah, baby!
Download free for iPhone and Android in the App Store.
This is David Spradley, and you should check out Z, the SEO queen.
Do you have an online business or want an online business but lack the team or the expertise to get on Google page one? Did you know that 33% of all Google search traffic clicks the first result only? Do you want to get more traffic to your website, social media profile, or just want your video to get more hits or go viral? Well, you need to contact the SEO Queen Digital Marketing Agency, where you are more than just a number. You can't lose with the SEO Queen. More visibility, more credibility, more profitability. Visit theseoqueen.net for more information. That's theseoqueen.net. theseoqueen.net. That's theseoqueen.net.
Hello, this is Lady Z, a violinist. I'm coming to you because I want to encourage you to get your copy of Elevate. It's available on Apple Music and iTunes, Amazon, and Google Play. So if you're listening to this on your computer or your cell phone, whether you have an Android or an iPhone, you can get your copy of this song, this show's theme song, by just going to Apple Music, Amazon, or Google Play and get it today. I appreciate your support. Thank you.
This is David Spradley, and you're listening to the Jazz and Tech Lounge with Lady Z.
Welcome to the Jazz and Tech Lounge with Lady Z, a podcast about the secrets to success in technology, music, and business on Bashani Radio, iHeartRadio, and iTunes. Bashani Radio, always talking about everything from New York City. You can listen to the Jazz and Tech Lounge with Lady Z on any mobile phone or tablet device. The Jazz and Tech Lounge with Lady Z, where we explore tech and enjoy the music and learn secrets to success in music, business, and technology. Please follow us online at www.ladyz.com and on all social networks at Lady Z. My next guest is very creative, a musician, an attorney. He is the authority on the Houston's leading authority on Doctor Who. He has spoken at Houston's Comic Palooza for the last 6 years. And he's also on the faculty of the University of Texas in Houston. And his band, the 50 Cent Drink Night, featuring the Velvet Juice, is doing some great things in the community. So I just wanted to introduce to some and present to others, Mr. Ira Dominitz. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, doing very well. If I can just offer one tiny correction, only because I'm an attorney, we just tend to do this, is that I actually teach CLEs for the University of Texas, and I actually have to go up to Austin from Houston to actually do it. So that's pretty much the only clarification I have.
Okay. Awesome sauce. So can you copyright a hashtag? That's my first question for you.
Copyright might be a little bit difficult. Copyrights, just so you know, we're talking to your audience and so people understand, copyrights are protections that exist for artistic works expressed in a tangible medium. What that means is that anything you see, it's an artwork, such as a painting, musical piece, basically the writing up, music notation of a musical piece. Anything like that can be copyrightable. That being said, if there's a hashtag that has some sort of artistic aspect to it, theoretically, you could actually copyright it. Some people, though, they might look more towards a trademark. Trademarks actually protect identification of source of goods. So, for example, if you were somebody who, I don't know, was called the SEO queen, and basically that's what you were known as, that's how your business was generated, that's how you actually were known in the community as a source of information or source of services, that would be something you could certainly look at to actually seek trademark protection on.
Register. Yeah, I need to trademark my hashtag, the SEO queen, because I don't want nobody using it but me or when they're referring to me. You could use it if you were referring to me, but not, you know, saying you're the SEO queen hashtag. I don't like that.
Just use it like you were The Rock and you were a wrestler. The SEO queen says, the SEO queen, you know, the people's elbow SEO queen, anything you like. You can just use it.
Well, I'm going to have to definitely make that happen. But what made you go into law? Like, what drew you to the legal profession?
When I was younger, my dad was a physician, and I basically respected the people that ran hospitals. I kind of wanted to become a hospital administrator. So I thought the proper route would probably go medical school. But so I took all the pre-med courses, got a minor in chemistry of undergraduate, and then basically applied to medical school, and I didn't get into medical school. My grades were good enough. It was just a very difficult time in the application cycle. I applied to law school thinking maybe I'll take the alternative route and become an administrator for medical or for basically hospitals based on having a legal degree. But what I found out in law school is that I really liked intellectual property. And I found out, especially when I graduated law school, I could qualify and sit for the patent bar. So I could become possibly a licensed patent agent and write patents for people. So what I did is I took the patent bar and passed it and haven't looked back since. I've been practicing patent law, both in litigation and drafting patents, as well as other issues that have to do with intellectual property, like copyrights and trademarks.
Oh, wow. So there's different types of legal exams?
There absolutely are different types of legal exams. Every state requires that you pass the exam for that state. The patent bar itself is a specialized exam that's designed for people to have engineering degrees. You could take the patent bar if you liked. you actually take the
I could take the patent bar.
You could take the patent bar, and people that take the patent bar that do not have a law degree, and they pass the patent bar, they become patent agents. And then they can draft patents, and there's certain things they can do. They can't provide legal advice, but they can certainly draft patents. The patent bar is one of the toughest exams in the country, usually around a 40 to 50% pass rate.
Oh, wow. All right, I had to bribe the kid. Now he's gone.
I'm sure you've seen the classic thing from the guy who gets interviewed by the BBC.
Oh, yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's one of my favorite ones. When the happy toddler comes in there and the bouncer and all excited and the other one comes in there too. Or actually the other one comes in first and then the happy toddler comes in. The wife comes in and skids into the... It's very funny.
Wow. So where were we?
We were talking about how you can sit for the patent bar and become a patent agent.
Oh, yeah. You're just saying hypothetically I could.
No, you could actually.
Well, I mean, what kind of questions are on this patent bar?
It's really simple. Patent bar actually will ask you questions about how to actually draft a patent. So it's really a procedural test. It's not going to ask you questions such as, you know, let's just say a train leaves Chicago going 300 miles an hour and one leaves Philadelphia going west.
It's not like taking the SAT, in other words.
It's literally, here is the patent manual procedure, which is 2,000 pages long.
Okay.
If you get an office action and it says, let's say if something's anticipated, how do you respond? You know, A, you do this. B, you do that. C, you do this. D, you do the other. That's basically, it's all basically a test of procedure.
Oh, okay. That's not too tough.
It's kind of tough. They get kind of real nitpicky.
Oh, okay. Well, how big is the procedure manual to study?
About 2,000 pages.
Oh, see? I'm not even...
Courses online are cheap.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
How long did you study for the patent bar?
I came to Houston, and I didn't have a job when I came after graduating law school.
Uh-huh.
And I literally sat for the patent bar and studied for 2 months. And that would be just me spending 2 to 3 hours a day at Barnes & Noble, reading through the passages, doing the practice stuff they give you. And then I sat for the test in late October and passed the first time. So.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. So, like, what exciting is happening in the world of intellectual property right now?
Well, there's tons happening that's very exciting, intellectual property, including just as recently as the Lady A, Lady Antebellum case.
Oh, yeah, let's talk about that. That's sure. Definitely a multi-layered segment or news.
It's a hot topic.
Hot topic. Thank you. That's what I was looking for. That's a hot topic.
The hot topic concept comes into trademark. Trademarks are very nuanced. And without getting into the facts as to who's right and who's wrong, because I don't have all those in front of me, and I don't think anybody does quite yet, but concept of trademark is simply this: use it or lose it. So if somebody actually is using a trademark nationally, where it's nationally recognized, let's just say Lady A, and let's say Lady A has recordings. If Lady A has been doing it starting in, let's just say, 2010, and Lady A has a 10-year history of using the term Lady A as an identifier of source of goods, namely her stage name, then basically she has what we would call probably a common law trademark. It's not registered, but people know who the name is, people are associating with it, and it is used in the identification of source of goods.
Mm-hmm.
That's how that would work. Now, Lady Antebellum, from my understanding of the case, and factually, again, I don't have all the facts in front of me. And
yeah, I read an article about it. So my understanding is they didn't want, you know, Antebellum because of its, you know, white supremacist connotations. And so they decided to just shorten it to Lady A. But
and my understanding a little bit further is that Lady A was a trademark that they registered with the trademark office, the federal registration, and got the trademark granted, I want to say 2011, around there. So you're talking about a situation in which you have somebody who's been using a mark, a registered mark, for 9 years, and there was no opposition filed to it. And you're talking about a situation in which you have an artist who's been using it as identifier of source of goods for effectively, let's just say, 20 years or however long she's been using.
Right.
So the question comes in, how does that work? Who has the rights? Who has the priority to use the mark? Who can actually use the mark now? Now, in some cases, the courts and basically the law will come down and say you can have contiguous use. And what that means is, for example, if somebody's been using, let's just say, Lady A for 20 years, they may not have as many followers as somebody else, as Lady A for Lady Antebellum. But what you can actually establish is that they've been using it, and let's say they've been using it on Spotify or something that actually has a national presence, even if they have a very few amount of people that are associating with it. If it is still a nationally known identifier source of goods, it might be that they might have same usage. In other words, they both might have a right to use the mark. In other words, live well together, play in the sandbox together, and don't hurt each other type of ruling could come out from this. Another thing that could come out too is that, let's just say somebody has a registered trademark. If they register a trademark, but they're not actively using it, even if it's registered, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're entitled to stop other people from using it if they've been using it previously and they've been using it continuously. So it's going to be a real tricky mix-up in terms of facts and how they establish the facts to who's been using it first, who used it continuously.
Right.
And how is it basically, for lack of a term, how is it actually realized or viewed in the public? How many, is it really that both of them are nationally recognized names? There have been very famous cases in which, let's just say big companies, like I'll just use Apple as an example, I'm not going to give a case name, but Apple may be wanting to have an I something, iPod they've got, I've got iPhones. And if they have something, it was like, let's just say iKeyChain. I'm looking at my keychain right now. And somebody else already had iKeyChain, even if it wasn't used as predominantly nationally. I know there's been situations which big companies, whether it be Apple or other companies that are very large, have been stopped from getting trademarks because of the fact that there's a smaller company who sort of beat them to the punch and actually was using the mark ahead of them.
Wow, that's interesting. So
there's one more nuanced aspect to it as well. And that's the concept of continuous use. So for example, let's just use Lady A and Lady Antebellum, just so we can distinguish them.
Okay.
Lady A has been continuously using it for 20 years. That's 20 years use. If Lady Antebellum had used it for, let's just say, 2 or 3 years in 2011 to 2013 and then stopped using it for a while and nobody had any association with that name being the previous Lady Antebellum, then you're going to be put in a situation in which, okay, they didn't have continuous use of the mark. So if you stop using the mark, you sort of start over the timeline of how long you've been using it.
Wow. This is really fascinating. I know for me, I've been, you know, the more you invest in your brand, the more and more you think about your intellectual property and your brand and the goodwill that you generate. So at what point do you think a business really needs to start thinking about, you know, their intellectual property and protecting it?
I always will suggest this. And again, I'm not providing legal advice or, you know, I'm giving just general information. So I'm not actively taking people right now, you know, like you're a client or something. Essentially, I'm not providing legal advice. I'm just saying in general, and I have to say that as a lawyer.
Your disclaimer.
My disclaimer.
You're indemnified. Go ahead.
I'm indemnified. But I'd say this, before you even file your business, before you even file your LLC or your PLLC or your incorporation or whatever you're going to do, you need to be thinking about your intellectual property as the first order of business. Let me tell you why. I've been involved in many circumstances in which companies are formed. And let's say they form a company and they incorporate in the great state of Texas, where I'm in right now, where I live. They incorporate the great state of Texas and its company, let's just call it Basic. Company's name is Basic Incorporated. If people don't actually do a search on the internet to see if Basic Incorporated is already out there or to see if Basic Incorporated is actually trademarked or registered trademark, even worse, you can put money, massive amounts of money into a corporation only to find out that you're going to have to change your corporate name in the first instance because there's already an internet presence of another company that has the same name. That happens a lot.
Wow. You know what? I think I did do a mark search before I registered my domain, because I remember I did a search on social media and some other things.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I think I did do that. But I mean, that's such a great tip because, you know, it's a lot of work to build up your brand and then, you know, to have somebody infringe upon it. I know it makes me mad.
Well, even worse than that is to build up your brand and find out you inadvertently are infringing on somebody else. You put the money in your corporation and now all of a sudden you've got to change the name, relabel, all sorts of things that go into it. So in the first instance, it's always best to make a prudent search. I suggest usually that companies, if they can do it, have five names that they're interested in. And search all five, and you'll see pretty quickly on the internet if there's a presence, if one has, let's say, 5,000 hits, not a good choice.
Right.
If one has two hits, much better choice.
Mm-hmm. So in your experience, if you're looking at marks and like you find two, like how often are marks abandoned?
Oh, very frequently. They're abandoned quite a bit. When you file a mark and you register a mark at the USPTO, you have certain deadlines and certain things that you need to accomplish in a period of time. Mm-hmm. Usually what they call it is the 5 to 8 year. And what happens is after a period of time of filing the mark, the USPTO will say, do you still want this mark or do you want to go abandon? And how this works is that they send the attorney of record, they're supposed to at least, they send them a little reminder that says, hey, your 5 year notification for this is up on this date. You need to file your 5 year statement on this date, by this date, otherwise it goes abandoned. And why they do that is really quite simple, because some companies will last less than 5 years.
Right.
And if a company lasts less than 5 years, say the last 4 years, they really don't have a need to keep that trademark live because it's not identifying anything. It's not really identifying the source of goods.
Right.
So they charge you money too to actually do your renewal, which makes sense because that make people pay money, they take interest in it and take it seriously. So that's the way that they actually sort of police the marks. Now, can you have a mark that's been going on for theoretically hundreds of years? Sure you could. Coca-Cola, Nike, all sorts of stuff like that can be going for a very, very long period of time.
Don't forget McDonald's.
McDowell's. I'll go down.
That's a trademark.
Coming to America, apart from being a great movie, has so many lessons that you can learn of intellectual property. It's not even funny. It's literally the great teaching movie for trademarks.
Okay, why is that? I mean, Coming to America, that movie has a special place in my heart for a multitude of reasons, okay. One of which my violin teacher is in the opening scene.
Oh.
So he was one of the violinists on the balcony.
James Amos, who is, again, one of my favorite actors of all time,
mm-hmm.
He basically owns McDowell's.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And McDowell's, if you can imagine, looks very similar to McDonald's, but upside down.
Right.
And the whole thing and the whole concept is, and at one point I believe he says something to the effect of, I keep having to deal with those guys on trademark or something like that issues. He says something about I have to deal with them on issues of the name. So that's actually a great teaching tool. If you're going to have McDonald's and you want to have a thing called McDowell's, well, trademark prevents you from doing that because it's a likelihood of confusion as the source of goods.
Right.
That's why people, let's just say, I can't believe it's not butter. If they had, I can't believe it's not, tangerines. Then basically you'd be sitting in a situation in which, clearly they're using the I can't believe it's not butter as a method or a tool to garner business because people will say, oh, it's the same company who did this. Therefore, I can't believe it's not tangerines. Perfect for me to use.
Wow. I've never, as many times as I've seen that movie Coming to America, I never really thought about it from an intellectual property point of view.
Well, it's a great movie though too, so.
Yeah, it is hilarious. I think they're supposed to be, they were filming before this pandemic, Coming to America too. So we'll see if they finished it or not.
I hope it has Samuel L. Jackson in it.
Well, I hope it's funny.
I just got to say, Samuel L. Jackson, again, one of my favorite actors of all time. People don't realize he was in that movie, too.
He was?
He was the guy who went to rob him.
Oh, he was the bum on the street.
Uh-huh, that went to rob McDowell's.
Oh, yeah. He's been in so many movies.
Yes, he has.
So, question. Does your practice cover, do you deal with issues of slander and libel too, or just strict? Oh, you do?
Yeah.
So what's the craziest situation you've had to deal with?
That's a good question. And of course I have to put my legal hat on and say, how much can I say? I can say
indemnify yourself and speak in generalities.
I can say we've dealt with ones with people running for office that have made slanderous remarks about non-public figures. I can say that business defamation is always a constant thing that we see. People don't realize that businesses are like people in many instances. Mm-hmm. If you're a business, you can't like say, for example, I'm just going to use an example. If you're McDonald's, you can't really say Burger King is horrible and they do this and basically spout lies about them. Right. You're not really allowed to do that. That'd be called business disparagement.
You can get sued for that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Like Oprah did when she said what she said about beef and cows.
I think the cattle industry had a big problem with that, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. She got into a big lawsuit, and that's how she met Dr. Phil.
Dr. Phil.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Phil. I wasn't thinking about Dr. Phil, but yes. And I was thinking actually that there's an actor from the 70s and 80s who always reminded me of Dr. Phil, a guy named Jeff Tambor.
Uh-huh.
He looked very, a young Jeff Tambor looked very much like Dr. Phil.
Oh, wow. So I, you know, I don't know how many of my listeners do know that corporations are treated like people and, you know, you can be sued for defamation or you said business disparagement.
Yeah. Usually also business disparagement comes in situations in which I'm sure people have done this all the time where basically somebody really hates an experience they had at the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is they start posting all over the internet about how restaurant X or blah, blah, blah was horrible. And then makes up stories. They serve roaches. The bathrooms were terrifying. The wait staff, you know, had just oozing flesh wounds, just absolutely egregious, ridiculous things. Well, when they start publishing on the internet, all of a sudden you've got something that's published and it's going to the public. And if it's a statement made with malice, and there are other rules that apply per each state for defamation, mm-hmm. theoretically, they could be defaming a business right there.
Right.
An individual could be defaming a business. So it's not that you shouldn't write a fair review about a place. It's just that sometimes when people think they're very brave and they're just going to do a favor for a friend and rip into a business because somebody was angry at somebody, or, you know, Susie and Jeff and Becky didn't get along and now, you know, they're going to show Becky a lesson and write scathing reviews on the internet. Be cautious of the fact that once it's published, it's published. Now you're getting in defamation territory.
Right. And you open yourself up for a possible lawsuit.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. You know, I definitely, you know, my clients are business owners, so I don't openly criticize any business. That's my policy.
Yeah, and again, with the understanding that you can give a fair review,
mm-hmm.
just understand that if it's going to be a fair review, it has to be a fair review with basically factual backing. Is something that should be thought about too. If basically somebody right. did accidentally serve you a roach in something, well, you can say, I was served a roach and I'm not going back there again. I'm very upset.
Right.
But when you start making up stories about things or starting to defame people, or just, you know, yeah, you get lots of issues once it gets published on the internet.
Right. So what three things do you think entrepreneurs can do to protect their intellectual property moving through this whole pandemic era?
Well, that's a great question. And I would suggest this. If you're working at your business, you know, obviously keep your business going as best as you can, do whatever you can to stay afloat because it's a very difficult time and nobody knows what's going to happen in any state at any given moment. I will say this though. If you have the opportunity to examine or take some time to examine what your business actually owns, and I don't mean ownership of physical goods, because everybody takes inventory of, let's just say, a warehouse full of masks or full of whatever you want, that's great. Take an inventory of what your intellectual property is as well. For example, if you find that you have a brand that's really a big selling brand, and you want to make sure to protect it so your competition can't do what we call ride off your coattails, or steal your instant business, I'd highly suggest that what you do is look into protecting that brand. Look into trademarking it, looking into the various options of what you can do with federal registration. I'll absolutely say this, if you're a musician, if you are anybody involved in the artistic area, one of the best protections you can get is copyrights. And the big question we get is all the time, don't copyrights start the minute that you actually have a copyright or you make an artistic work? Well, yeah, they do. The minute you make a painting or a drawing, you get a copyright in it. However, you don't have a registered copyright in it. And it's really interesting because if you're going to try and go to court and say that I own this copyright, the first question they're going to have even before they let you in court is, did you register it? Why do you register it? Really simple, because registration will set the time frame. It will set the time saying, I had this work created at this date and I registered it. Therefore, anybody who comes after me, you're out of luck because I registered it. I did what I was supposed to do. Otherwise, it becomes sort of a he said, she said argument. I did that painting. No, I did the painting. No, I did the painting. Did anybody register it? No. So why are we here? Also, copyright registration can be relatively cheap.
It's like $50, right?
$55.
Yeah, it's
$55.
It's not that bad.
There's some nuanced things to it, like if you make a record, how many songs can you have?
Right.
You know, published it. I mean, that's why you need to talk to an attorney, because it can get kind of complicated and they do change the rules frequently. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, if you've got something and it's artistic and you like it and you're going to go out and sell copies of it,
right?
Then the first thing you should be saying, if I'm selling copies of this thing, I should be copywriting it registration.
Exactly.
And you can get your attorney's fees potentially if you win in a lawsuit.
Right. Because, you know, my attitude is like, I don't want anybody using my intellectual property without my permission or knowledge or without compensating me properly.
Yeah. There's a lot to it. There's a lot of nuance to it. Sometimes if you get lucky, let's say you make a song and somebody picks it up and then all of a sudden they start playing it without your knowledge and you happen to have the stuff let's just say you have this stuff on a record or you're selling a record that has a song. Maybe you get lucky and it goes viral and you sell a million copies and everybody loves it. More often than not, what's going to happen is somebody finds something they like that you did, steal it, and they're going to keep the money.
Yeah, that actually, I think I heard one of my friends wrote a book and they took the book and just put their own cover on it and was selling it as theirs. I've heard of that happening too.
There's a lot of things that actually go into it. There's the old classic scenario of, I want to actually make some money. So I know that I'm going to a place that has a lot of affluent people that are going to pay for goods as long as I brand it differently and don't tell them what it is. So what they do is they go buy those big, I use the word chungus, the big chungus Hershey bars, the giant ones, the big huge ones. Mm-hmm. And then what they do is they unwrap them, they rewrap them with their own special wrap and sell them as like a gourmet delicacy at 10 times the price.
Oh, wow.
And then all of a sudden you got a problem because, wait a minute, you just sold the Hershey bars, you know, and you're selling them at a jacked up price. And are you telling people the Hershey bars? Well, sometimes you can get away with it because you bought the Hershey bars, so you can do whatever you want once you buy something. But there are rights in terms of passing off of goods. Somebody gets injured or ingests a nut in that Hershey bar, and all of a sudden Hershey's going to say, well, I didn't have anything to do with this. You know, there's lots of issues that go into it.
Wow.
Rebranding is what it would be, or repurposing it and claiming that it's your brand when it's really not. That's a problem too.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really crazy. So domain names.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts about, that's another hot topic when it comes to intellectual property. What are your thoughts about domain names?
Domain names are very tricky. And the reason why domain names are tricky is that when it first came about, there were issues of some adult entertainment sites getting some really clever ideas. That mm-hmm. what they would do is they would purchase all these domain names when it was a hot topic, very, very cheap.
Right.
Well-known stuff. Let's just say like Continental, you know, things that are major airlines or Enterprise, things like that. So they'd snatch up all these domain names. And then what they do is they sit on them. It's cyber squat. Mm-hmm. And then they'd have them all lead to adult sites. So if somebody wanted to go buy tickets, let's say to go on an airplane, and they wanted to buy them for Continental, they go to Continental, all of a sudden an adult site pops up. Now that's a problem for Continental. That's a problem for any industry that's trying to get involved in the internet. And so what they did is they enacted some laws, basically anti-cyber squatting provisions of the Trademark Act. What these do is they prevent people from doing exactly that. Grabbing up a domain name of a famous company and holding it hostage, essentially, until somebody comes and pays an exorbitant amount to get the website or domain name back.
There's laws against that.
You can't. Yeah, there are laws against that.
Well, I mean, shoot. So, I mean, I could technically sue, potentially, for that domain that I want, that I told you I wanted.
Well, it's a little trickier than that. And the reason is because one of the things that they have to do is they have to pass a test. And the test basically isn't so much that somebody owns it or they're using the domain name. The test is basically how famous is the mark that's being hurt.
That's the key. Yeah.
If it's a famous mark, for example, if you had Nike.com,
mm-hmm.
and you snatched it up, but Nike's selling millions and millions of shoes. Well, if you're holding Nike hostage and you're not really doing anything with the website, and even if you have a business and all you're doing is keeping it a blank website, sure, Nike can bring cause of action to get the domain site domain relinquished from you over to them, basically assigned to them, saying that they have the rights to it and that all you're doing is cyber squatting. And there are penalties for it too. It's not as easy as, you know, it's not as simple as just any old website will do. They have to show it's a famous mark. And the reason why is because otherwise it will prevent people or everybody be suing everyone to say, I'm better at this than you are.
Uh-huh.
And even though let's just say the mark is Otter Fan. If Otter Fan is the mark and somebody had Otter Fan, the grocery store, and somebody had Otter Fan that actually was a movie theater, well, you know, whoever has that domain name, they might have rights over the other one simply because Otter Fan is not a famous mark.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It does get tricky.
Yeah, I guess I'm stuck paying the squatter's price. It's what?
It is tricky.
I mean, I do get over 1 million downloads and streams to my podcast, but I don't know if that's enough.
It's a fact issue, and that's kind of how it comes down to. I mean, the more information you have to support the fact that you're a known entity,
mm-hmm.
For example, if you register trademarks, if you basically been using it for X amount of years, if you have can show a million viewers or 1 million people who actually download the podcast, mm-hmm. if you can show that you T-shirts and stuff, if you can show that people are doing this across the country. For example, you know, not just people in LA, but people in New York, people in Washington State, people in Florida. Right. All those are factors that goes towards establishing, if lack of a better term, the absolute famousness of the mark. Can I say that?
Man, so there's actually a standard for how famous someone is in the court of law.
It kind of, yeah. I mean, it's not a hard line test of you need to have 1.6 million hits or anything. But what they do is they do surveys, essentially, is what they do. You know, are you familiar with this? Do you know this person? Yeah, it's Lady Gaga. Oh, okay, sure. Now, you know, 30 people out of 40 will recognize who you are. That's pretty famous.
Yeah, that is pretty famous. But unfortunately, I'm Google famous. Only 40, well, total for everything is 64 people a month searching for either the SEO queen or Lady Z.
Yeah, but you'll get there. You'll be at the million pretty soon.
Yeah, I will, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to get that domain name before, you know, any hell ish hits the fan. Because I'm like, really, like, feeling like someone's circling around my domain. I feel that.
If you feel that the wolves are closing in, you need to set up the reinforcements and set up the defenses.
Yeah, because I think pursuing, like, a legal offensive to prove how famous I am. It's probably way cheaper and more effective to just buy it.
That would be actually much more expensive. Yeah, too. Yeah. I'll tell you this. Like, for example, let's say a website costs $2,000 to get an expert report and basically a legitimate, let's just say a legitimate survey taken. Mm-hmm. Legitimate survey taken of an expert report, it's going to be at least
$20,000. Yep, it's cheaper to just buy the domain.
Yeah, it might even be more. I mean, I've seen some expert reports that have cost $100,000.
Whoa!
I don't think that's this case, though, so don't worry about it.
Man, whew, attorneys make all the money.
No, we're not experts. We don't get to, don't get me wrong, we don't get to charge that much. Be nice.
Wow. So what do you want to leave our listeners with? You want to share anything about your band or?
Well, I can say that, you know, I've been in a band. I have trademarked the Velvet Jew. So I have trademarks to my name. Wrote a book when I was in college. I actually have a copyright for that. I can say this. I would love to, you know, people have questions or they have individual issues. I do practice all across the nation. So I practice intellectual property law, which is governed by federal law, which means that pretty much I get clients ranging from California all the way to New York. So if anybody's
in- That is so cool.
If anybody's any questions, they can contact us at our firm if they like.
Okay. How can they contact you at your firm?
Our firm phone number is 713-463-6000, and they basically just ask for me, and usually we'll give a free initial, you know, 15 to 30 minute consultation depending on what the issues are, and after that, if it's something that people need to pursue further, we can talk to them about pricing and how we can go about helping them.
Well, if you are having any questions about your intellectual property, I highly recommend Ira Dominant. He definitely knows what he's doing. You definitely know, because, you know, I went through the trademark process for Lady Z for my logo, so I know how intricate the process is, and it's always nice to have an expert in the law to hold your hand through the process. So.
Well, thank you, and I'd like to thank you again for having me on today, and you know, I always close with this these days, which is absolutely be safe and be healthy to you and yours.
Well, thank you so much. And definitely, I want to echo those sentiments as well. And until next time.
This is David Spradley, and you're listening to the Jazz and Tech Lounge with Lady Z.
Your mommy, your daddy, and all your friends, and tell them New York's number one podcast app is blowing up the airwaves and they can't do nothing about it. Bashani Radio app. We global, baby.
Yeah, baby!
Download free for iPhone and Android in the App Store.